Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast that brings you all of the crime and none of the cattle. This is All Crime, No Cattle. I'm Aaron. I'm here with the Canine Crime Unit, Brianne and Nelson. They are very excited to be with us, as you can tell.
Meaning they're passed out.
Mm-hmm. And with us today is my favorite co-host.
Your only co-host.
Seamus Worldwide.
Not official nickname. That's... But anyways, yes, I am here, and I am Detective Shea Butter. I am Detective Shaw.
Don't forget Dork Nowinski, my favorite one.
I was about to get to that one, but thank you for bringing that up. Yes, I am Dork Nowinski. If you're listening to this, that means that we're inside Austin. We're in you, Austin. We're about to have Texas Podocalypse Austin Edition.
That's right, for those of you who are planning to come. I hope there are more than one.
I've seen at least a couple people Facebooking and tweeting about it. I saw someone saying they were going to bring you fleshy bones and they were going to bring me cow jokes.
Done.
Laugh
and
face.
Done.
That post. Yeah.
You laugh face.
What do you call it? Just ha 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 face. Like, what do you call that? I like that post.
There you go. Yeah. Bring me what you got.
Please, no fleshy bits. Please. I really don't want fleshy bits.
Some additional margaritas?
Yeah. Shots of tequila. That's all welcomed. Let's do that.
I'll take your fleshy bits, though.
No, I don't want to drive all the way back to Fort Worth with fleshy bits in the car.
Well, you know what? They're not for you. And this is going to be our final announcement for getting money into the donation for the big raffle that we're doing right now for Texas Equisearch, a really great cause. Go to any of our social media. You can find the post there and you can donate through Facebook or directly through their website. $5 will get you into the raffle for some of our merchandise. It's going to be really cool stuff. $20 or more will get you into the raffle for all of the podcasts that are participating. So you're going to get a ton of merchandise. It's going to be awesome. We're going to be probably ending it at towards the end of the month sometime. And we're going to be picking our winners, so please go do that if you were still planning on it. Remember, $5, that's all you need to get into this little mini raffle. You still have a really good chance of winning because we still don't have that many takers on the $5 level.
Yeah, so, honestly, did have a run with the $5 donations recently this week since last episode. So
we know you're listening. But it's still honestly like not that much. So yeah. Truly, you have a really good chance of winning. So plus, you get the added pleasure of donating to a very good cause.
Yeah, and remember, get those screenshots of your donation in so that we can verify that you actually donated.
Yeah, don't forget to do that. I think I've forgotten to mention that.
Yeah, follow all the rules that we have in our pinned posts on all of our social media. If you follow those rules, you're good to go. You're golden. You're in the raffle. And yeah, it should be awesome. With no further ado, can we get into this week's episode, Aaron? Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Are you pumped?
Yep.
All right. Well, it's episode 30. That means our little baby of a podcast is getting into its new 20s. We're having a rebirth. We're experiencing a rejuvenation of our youth. We're going to branch out and do some new stuff, but we're mature and we have the wisdom of everything we've gone through before.
We've left the binge drinking and the partying all night behind, and our future is 401ks and weird, gross, bad back gross situations, and hopefully treating ourselves better.
Yeah, we're going to give up some of those vices. We're going to start eating salads. It's going to be great. Well, this episode, like I said, episode 30, this is the murder at La Kiva. Disclaimer for this episode. This week's case is what you might call a humdinger if you're from West Texas. Stick with me, and I'm going to attempt to find some sort of justice in this case. I'm really going to lean on Aaron for her opinion, and we're going to have some supposition. But I wanted to give you a heads up that there's going to be a lot of, quote, alleged, as some of our opinions may come into play after I present the facts of this particular case. I will say, this case involves some topics that I really wanted to get into, and specifically, it's going to relate to money and funds as far as a person's defense, as well as how a trial can run its course. Aaron should be happy, though, because there's going to be some bone talk.
Yay!
So sources today come from several different news outlets. There's not a lot of people in Southwest Texas. It's the desert and a canyon area. Really, our sources are pretty few and far between, but we're going to use a lot of articles, and I'll go ahead and list those out. So Outside Online, Terlingua Today, Your Basin News, Odessa American Online, The Houston Chronicle, The Big Bend Gazette, of course, Texas Monthly, Aaron. How could we do a case without Texas Monthly?
We've done several without Texas Monthly. Let me state that for the record.
But they might have been better if we used Texas Monthly, though.
Well, Texas Monthly's got to get on these cases that we're doing then.
I know. Big source for this case is going to come out of the Nat Geo highly debated documentary series, Badlands, Texas. There's only one season, and it only covers this case. And I guess I'll say about this particular documentary series, if you're interested in a lot of reality series kind of stuff and interpersonal relationships and community characters from this particular area, go ahead and watch it. But as far as the facts of the case, it probably could have been cut down from 8 episodes to 2. So what are we talking about with this Southwest Texas area? This week, I'm going to take you on a trip to one of my favorite places in Texas. It's one of the weirdest, quirkiest, and definitely one of the most unique places I've ever visited in the entire state of Texas. I'm talking about Terlingua. My old college buddies and I took a couple of road trips down to Terlingua many years ago, and it's a place that I still have a ton of fond memories of. Terlingua is a tiny town that packs a big punch of Texas desert culture. And I would personally say it's a must-see if you find yourself in the small corner of West Texas desert. Terlingua is located in Brewster County. This is the largest county geographically, Aaron. It takes up 6,192 square miles of the entire state. That's a lot of land. It's also one of the least populated counties of the whole state, though. So it's approximately around 9,000 total people that live in this whole county. And if you're doing the math, that's 1.5 people per square mile.
Well, so, that's a lot of room to spread out, spread your wings, do whatever weird Terlingua stuff you're up to.
That's a very big point that we're going to talk about in this case is, okay, 1.5 people per square mile. Think about a square mile. You could die of natural causes out in the middle of the desert in a canyon, and no one would know, probably ever, unless they just stumbled upon you out there, right? But also consider that Sol Ross University is in Brewster County, and around 2,000 students that are there, most of them register to vote while they are college students and attending Sol Ross University so that they can vote on things via Brewster County. And much of that student body doesn't live in Brewster County. So cut that 9,000 total people down by 2,000 more. Terlingua sits just on the other side of the Rio Grande River from Chihuahua, Mexico, and it's located between the small towns of Lajitas and Studi Butte, Texas. Most visitors to Terlingua are simply passing through on their way to Big Bend National Park, and rightfully so. There's not a whole lot to do out there. If you're in that area, you're probably going to Big Bend. Hey, Big Bend's amazing. It's an awesome national park. I highly recommend it. It's full of lots of really cool slot canyons, lots of stuff to see.
I know, never been. Man, I would love to go.
It's one of the places that I got to go a lot, and I really want to take you one day.
Well, take me. Let's go. Let's All do right, it.
Let's do it. But I would suggest you should definitely stop off for an ice cream, a souvenir, or just a cold beer and a conversation with a normal Terlinguan. It's a great way to spend your time while you're in the Texas desert. And just for the weirdness factor and the people watching, it's top notch. They have a really cool old cemetery and a walking tour of the old Quicksilver mining town nearby. They also feature a historic Starlight Theater and a world-famous international chili cook-off. And of course, the focus of this week's episode, a crazy local bar called La Kiva. Now that the mercury mines are all shut down, and the big mercury boom, if you can believe that was a thing at one point in time, That's all done with in the early 1900s. So Terlingua has now gone from a population of around 3,000 people at the height of the mercury boom to just over a mere 60 residents at the last census. That's tiny, right?
Yeah, and it's surprising because you mentioned the chili cook-off. That's how I know Terlingua, is the huge chili cook-off that happens that gets people from all around the world to go there, which Texas chili is a weird thing.
Yeah.
Because Texas chili is no beans, and I prefer my beans with my chili.
Well, they have several categories, and bean chili is one of them.
Okay, good. So yeah. I'll be happy there.
Yeah. Beyond that, though, there is a sense in Terlingua that if you're going to try and live there and not just visit, that you better be tough as nails. You better be tougher than the actual desert that you live in, because it's rough to try and subsist there. The desert is unforgiving. It's a dangerous place to try and make a living. Plus, there's not a lot of ways to make money in these parts. If you don't have a good set of skills, like you're a mechanic, you've also done some cattle rustling, you know how to work a generator, maybe you're good at selling RVs, probably not the best place for you to pick to live.
I'm not good at any of those things.
Yeah. By the way, I'll mention that the nearest hospital is over 100 miles away, so stay safe while you're out there in the middle of nothing. Don't get pricked by anything, don't touch anything.
Bitten by rattlesnakes.
Yeah, there's rattlesnakes, scorpions, spiders, mountain lions, just dying of exhaustion out in the middle of nothing.
Yeah, and don't get murdered.
Yeah, definitely don't get murdered.
I have a feeling that this all flows into the story we're about to get into.
Well, if you haven't picked up on the theme yet of our show, 9 times out of 10, there's murder involved. Some seasonal jobs are available, though, Aaron, but many residents of Terlingua are types of people that you might describe as survivalists, naturalists, jacks of all trades, off-the-grid types who cherish their freedom and tightness with their local community. It's a sort of desert hippie paradise of weirdness. And I would say that while I spent time in Terlingua, I met just as many geologists, nature guides, and paleontologists as I did musicians, herbalists, artists, gun lovers, and staunch constitutionalists. It's a really weird place to describe to people in just a few sentences. One of the best places to go and experience the, quote, Viva Terlingua attitude, or a sort of keep it weird sensibility, is, like we said, La Kiva Restaurant and Bar. La Kiva was built in 1981 by Gilbert Phelps. He was a miner, a teacher, and an all-around eccentric, who, yes, had a large scarlet macaw parrot on his shoulder at all times. This is what I'm talking about, judging from your face, but this is what I'm talking about when I refer to the eccentric nature and just the strangeness of Terlingua. Like, you might just run into a guy with a vest who's constantly wearing an exotic bird on his shoulder. Gil and some of his friends built La Kiva back in the early 80s, and it was in a lot down by Terlingua Creek, and they got a bunch of sandstone out of the creek, and they brought it up, and they dug out this area to make a bar. His idea was to build a sort of desert oasis for the community and a must-see tourist attraction for anybody passing through. La Kiva gets its name from the Pueblo people's term for a subterranean ceremonial chamber.
Oh, yeah. I was actually going to ask if that's how they got the name for Kiva. The Pueblo Native Americans would have kivas, and they were ceremonial sites for males, usually underground.
Yep.
So that's interesting that they actually built it out like a kiva, kind of. They dug it into the ground.
Yeah. And that was the whole idea about it. He wanted it to be like a spiritual, welcoming place, much as like the lizards and the rattlesnakes would go into the ground during the hottest part of the day. That's what he wanted La Kiva to be.
Okay.
Well, back when I first visited the bar, you parked out in this weird absence of anything parking lot that just had some boulders and a couple of weird mesquite trees, and it's right off the main road. And then you would get out of your car and you'd head towards this weird oversized door. Now, this door sat on like a 45-degree angle, and it was like an entrance to a mine or like a fallout shelter with this old-timey pulley and weight system connected to it just to help you open the damn thing. If that's not weird enough, once you got the door open, you'd head down into the coolness of the desert floor via some stone steps that brought you into the darkness of the bar proper. It was a weird, creepy experience, but luckily I had a friend who was a local, and he kept reassuring me that it was no big deal, everything was cool.
He wasn't about to murder you.
Yeah.
This isn't his, like, murder dungeon.
And funny you say dungeon, because it was very dungeon-esque when you got down there. Inside, the stone walls were covered with dimly lit bones and other strange curios.
Oh.
It was definitely, like, your kind of bar,
Aaron. I was about to say, this sounds pretty rad so far.
Yeah, and it's still open to this day, and I would love to take you there one day. It would be awesome to go and revisit. I feel like
we're planning our next road trip.
Yeah, we should. I mean, it's only 13 hours away, but Texas is big.
Texas is really big, guys. Yeah. For anybody outside of Texas, I think that they don't realize how big Texas is.
Yeah, I mean, Alaska's the only one that challenges us in size, and you've been there too, and you can attest how big Alaska is.
It's a big place.
Yep. I think you're going to find this interesting, Aaron. The bar's prized display piece, among all of its bone specimens, was a clearly fake conglomeration of bones set into the wall of La Kiva, like an excavated specimen with a small plaque nearby that simply stated, Penosaurus erectus.
Oh my god.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a mixture of different animal bones. Most of them look like cow and deer. It's just they found some animal bones that some people had nearby. They threw up some quick concrete and they just set them in there to make it look like something. And they called it Penosaurus erectus.
And what does it look like? What is it in the shape of?
Okay, let me show you real quick. For everyone's behalf, I'll post all these pictures in a video or on all of our social media platforms so you can check out what Penosaurus erectus looks like for yourself. But you can see this is La Kiva. This is the main bar room. Here's Penosaurus erectus over on the wall. And this is what it looked like. There's the plaque and there's all the bones.
It's so idiotic looking. I love it more than I can say. So it's got like a scapula for, I guess that's supposed to be its foot.
A back foot, yeah.
There's an entire pelvis.
For the head.
For the head and neck, because that neck part is a sacrum.
Yeah, it's a different and part so of a different pelvis.
It's like the actual, this whole entire spinal cord is actually backwards.
Yeah.
There's
a lot going on there. There's several spine parts and another
I love it.
Tail part.
As an anthropologist, I do have to say, though, I get why they said erectus. Well, first of all, you'd think that because it's Penosaurus erectus that it would feature a prominent penis, which it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
That's issue number one, I guess. Issue number two is Penosaurus erectus would mean that it would be, I guess, somewhat related to Homo erectus.
It's not erect. It's clearly quadrupedal.
Uh-huh.
But we digress. We don't need to get into all that.
I have so many questions.
We can have this debate at La Kiva when we're there.
It gives me so many ideas.
Yeah.
Can we make something like that in our house?
Probably.
Oh, yeah. I'm so excited.
Well, and beyond that, they also had a lot of petroglyphs that were clearly fake and just placed around the bar, you know, just...
But it's like a tongue-in-cheek type of thing.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a joke. It's supposed to be weird and funny. That's what I'm talking about when we discuss the Viva Terlingua attitude and the spirit of everybody who's there. It's just, let's make fun of everything, let's have a big party, and let's be crazy and stupid. Well, after Gil established La Kiva and its unique style, it quickly became the unofficial town hall and the cultural epicenter in the 80s. This is where bands would play, banquets would happen, weddings would happen there. Really important debates about the town would occur at La Kiva. Unfortunately, Gil passed away in 1989. And at that point, the family didn't know what they were going to do, but Glenn's nephew left an engineering job in Dallas and came down and took over running the bar. And he wanted,
really? Wow.
Yeah, and he wanted to run the bar in Gil's memory and, you know, embody Gil's spirit. And that's exactly what Glenn Feltz did. He was 50 years old, but he was a lovable, quirky, younger version of his Uncle Gil. He reopened La Kiva on April Fool's Day in 1991 with a Mad Hatter party, of course. He was obviously a big fan of weird hats. If you've looked up pictures of Glenn Feltz, he's always wearing like some strange, weird top hat with a bunch of feathers, maybe some bones, some weird stuff on it. makes me totally love this guy. Glenn was also known for throwing massive parties, organizing community functions, having crazy wild curly hair, but most of all, his kind, lovable nature is what represented Glenn Feltz to the community. Most residents of Terlingua had worked for Glenn at some point, or at least owed him a favor or two. He became a real iconic pillar of their strange little community, and many said around town that he embodied the Terlinguan spirit. So let's jump forward to Tuesday morning, February 4th, 2004. It's around 4 a.m. on a typical cold desert morning. I don't know if you've ever been to the desert, Aaron, but, you know, at nighttime, it gets really cold. You need to bring a jacket, and then you need to shed layers all day. An unidentified female employee of La Kiva came in early to reportedly clean and get the barbecue pit started and begin preparing the day's food for the restaurant. This employee stated she noticed that the bar's lights and the music were still on and went to Glenn Felt's home just at the rear of the property to let him know what was going on. While walking over to Glenn's house, the employee saw someone laying on the ground in the parking lot near the main door of La Kiva and just kept walking. She thought nothing of it, and according to locals, that sort of thing was pretty common for La Kiva.
So she just assumed this was like some drunk passed out?
Yes.
Okay.
And, you know, from partying at La Kiva myself, it gets pretty wild there. And I can imagine that's not atypical. The employee entered Felt's home and noticed his bed had not been slept in. At this point, she returned to discover the person laying in the parking lot was actually Glenn Feltz. And he wasn't sleeping off some drunken night. He was in fact dead and laying in a dried pool of his own blood with what looked like a serious head wound. At 8 a.m., the unidentified employee called 911 and reported what they had found. The sheriff of Brewster County, Ronnie Dodson, was contacted by a deputy who was originally dispatched to the scene. The deputy informed Sheriff Dodson that he was on the scene at La Kiva, and based on his assumptions, looking at the scene, it appeared Glenn Feltz had, in fact, been murdered. Sheriff Dodson told his deputy not to let anyone into the scene until he arrived. Oh, by the way, Sheriff Dodson was in Alpine, Texas, and that's about an hour and a half away. Dodson also shed some light on an interesting point about sheriff's offices in Brewster County and remote areas such as these. And basically, almost all officers in Brewster County can act in several ways during a murder investigation. And it's because of the geography and the size of the area. So they can serve in such roles as patrol officers, detectives, crowd control, media relations, forensic technicians, etc. And that's because most of them have experience working and training with Texas Rangers. So if you are the first reporting officer to a murder in Brewster County, you may well stay at the scene and work it constantly for the next 24 to 72 hours straight. Now you can imagine in a town this small, news travels fast. A crowd of friends began to develop at the crime scene. Glenn's body laid under a tarp for hours as deputies worked the scene. They took pictures of multiple sets of drag marks, shoe impressions, and a large singular mesquite tree. There was also a red stocking cap that people saw them photographing for about an hour or two. People that were standing by reported they saw blood stains. And of course, Glenn's body was out in the desert air, sitting there in the parking lot. Glenn's body sat there for about 8 hours. As the sun rose on Terlingua Valley, the day got very hot, as it's wont to do in the desert. So you can imagine, most of the residents are gathered at the scene waiting, and they all start giving statements to investigators as where they were on the night before. As they spoke with investigators, those working the scene began to get a sense of what the previous evening was like. Many people kept saying the same things. It was a typical slow Monday night at La Kiva, nothing out of the ordinary. Investigators kept searching, though, for clues in witness statements, and they soon began to emerge. Glenn Feltz and a close friend of his named Tony Flint had begun drinking together late into the night. They were still doing so as the bartender and another employee left for the night. Rhonda Herberer, one of Glenn's friends and co-workers, was there at the scene. She waited for answers with the others behind the crime scene tape. I mention Rhonda because she's a big part of the Texas Badlands documentary, but she is an important witness and a character witness for Glenn in his trial. And Rhonda was actually scheduled to work the previous night, but she had stayed home sick. And so she was there very concerned about what happened to Glenn. But around 10:30 a.m., Rhonda was sitting on the side of the road listening to friends give their statements when she saw a truck coming down the one singular road that goes through Terlingua. It was Tony Flint in his truck, and he drove past and waved at Rhonda as he went by. She thought it was really weird that Tony didn't stop to check and see what was going on, and it turns out Tony was headed to the sheriff's office to give a statement.
So somehow he heard the news. Okay. Yeah,
like we said, not many people that live there. News travels fast. Let's talk about Tony Flint for just a second. Tony was a former offensive lineman for Missouri State University. Though he still had his 6'3", 350-plus pound frame, he wasn't a football player anymore. He was 38 years old. And since 2009, he had begun making his living in Terlingua as one of the many seasonal river guides in the area. Tony had a lot of friends, and no one could imagine why or how he could have hurt the much smaller 150-pound, 50-year-old Glenn Feltz. After all, they were notably very close and great friends. What happened? But there were a few reports of arguing and roughhousing the night before, and specifically between Glenn and Tony. There was allegedly name-calling, slapping, bragging, light horseplay, etc. Captain Edward Cardoza of the Brewster County Sheriff's Office was at the station to take Tony's statement when he arrived. He described Tony as laid back, somber, and calm. The first part of his story followed the theme that witnesses had been describing. But what Captain Cardoza was much more interested in was what actually happened once the two men were alone and the bar had emptied. Tony states that sometime after midnight, he was helping Glenn up the stairs and out into the parking lot. Tony also stated he left Glenn sitting on one of the large boulders out front of La Kiva. Then he got into his truck and he drove home.
Okay, so Tony's story is Glenn was drunk. I'm assuming that from him saying that he had to help Glenn out of the bar. And after that, he left him outside of the bar and he went home. And I'm assuming to him, or at least according to his story, Glenn was then supposed to go on to his home, which was right there behind the bar, and everything was okay. So he's saying, last I saw of him, everything was fine. He was just pretty wasted, and that's all I know.
Well, he specifically stated that when he last saw Glenn, he was heavily intoxicated, which was not unusual for this type of night. But he was smiling and laughing, sitting on this boulder in front of La Kiva's entrance as he drove away. After that, he doesn't remember the drive home, he doesn't remember getting undressed, and he passed out. He felt that he needed to at least come and give a statement, probably because he's the last person that saw Glenn alive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Captain Cardoza also asked Tony what he was wearing the previous night. Just standard questions to ask a witness. And Tony answered. He said a set of overalls, a red stocking cap, a long sleeve shirt, and his Danner boots. Do you know what Danner boots are?
No.
Okay, they're a very common type of hiking boot. They have a big, like, Doc Marten-esque sole on them and leather material, and they lace up. They typically have red laces. They're a very standard hiking boot. Well, Captain Cardoza knew deputies were busy photographing the crime scene, and he had knowledge about shoe imprints and drag marks that were present. So,
and also that red stocking cap that they were taking pictures of.
Well, that's good that you mentioned that, because that didn't run across his mind yet, but it's good that it ran across yours.
Just call me Deputy Aaron.
That's right. He asked Tony if he would be willing to surrender his clothes as well as his boots from the night before, and Tony said, sure, no problem. He'd go home and he'd get them. Captain Cardoza said Tony was not a suspect, he was cooperating, and he cut him loose at that point. Back at the crime scene, there are three distinct sets of drag marks. Let's break those down for just a second. Drag mark one showed a dragging pattern that moved away from Lakeiva's entrance and headed west towards the back parking lot area for about 10 feet. So they're leaving from the direction of Lakeiva's door, but they're starting almost in the middle of the parking lot itself. Does that make sense?
Okay, so the drag marks themselves aren't coming directly from the door, but it looks like somebody was walking, fell, and then was dragged from that position.
Yes.
Okay.
And that drag mark is, like I said, about 10 feet towards the back parking lot area. These markings are weird because they are characterized by depressions in the loose desert sand that looks like Glenn's clawing fingers trying to get away. So he's got these grooves in the sand that look like his open hands being dragged through the desert floor. Theoretically, investigators believe he was being dragged face down and feet first.
Okay.
Drag mark two. This drag mark changes directions. It heads north for a dozen or so feet until it terminates at a mesquite tree. So it's heading towards the main road where you would leave the parking lot to a tree in the middle of the parking lot. At this mesquite tree, there were obvious signs of a struggle going on between Glenn and someone else. There were loose footprints, signs of a struggle, a red stocking cap was deposited, and dried pools of blood. Drag mark number three. This heads back toward the door of Lakeiva and was clearly the longest at 125 feet of drag mark.
Wow.
Something else interesting about this drag mark was that there are no claw marks. It's a single drag mark of what appeared to be an already unconscious Glenn Feltz, and that mark led right to his resting dead body.
Okay, so what it sounds like, if we can kind of reconstruct a scene just based on what we know now, so it sounds like Glenn was leaving Lakeiva, possibly going back to in the direction of his house. Somebody hit him or for whatever reason made him fall, but he's still conscious, so he's still trying to fight. They drag him to the area of the tree where he stands up and there's some kind of altercation again with additional violence because we have these pools of blood. Something additional happens to Glenn where he is knocked unconscious. And then somebody takes his unconscious body, starts pulling it back towards the bar, for some reason, maybe gives up. And then that's Glenn's final resting place.
Yeah, this final drag mark, like I said, it's 150 feet long. It's a solid mass that's being dragged. There's no finger marks like the first two.
Yeah, there's no signs of him trying to fight or get away.
And let's be clear, this is half of a football field.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. So I wonder why whoever did this, they would have taken the time to and the energy to drag a body so far and then only to leave it in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. Another thing to point out, though, which is a clue to the case, is each drag mark had large impressions nearby. And the only depressions that were nearby were those of a size 14 Danner boot.
How do they get shoe impressions from sand?
Well, it was an uncompromised crime scene. Captain Cardoza views the photos as they're coming into the station, as their, you know, deputies are processing everything that's going on and they're bringing stuff in little by little. And he recognizes the impressions in each photo that he's taking. And the impressions are of a Danner boot.
Okay, so this is fairly packed sand then.
Yeah.
If it can actually hold an impression of a shoe.
Yes. And again, I want to revisit that at every drag mark, there are several clear size 14 Danner boot impressions. And there are so many that they make up the majority of the crime scene photos. Like almost every photo they have has size 14 Danner boot impressions in them.
That's a big foot, by the way. That's like a NBA basketball player size foot.
Well, Captain Cardoza also saw the thing you saw, Aaron, that red stocking cap in those crime scene photos. And he remembered that Tony said he was wearing one. And that's when Captain Cardoza said, hey, enough's enough. We need to call Tony back in for a second interview. Tony, he volunteers to come back in. He brings all of his clothes like he said he was going to do. And among those clothes, he brought in the overalls, which had bloodstains on them. And he also brought in his Danner boots, which also had bloodstains on them. The boots are size 14, and the soles match the impressions to a T.
Okay, well, case closed.
Yeah, right? Seems cut and dry, right?
Yeah.
Captain Cardoza stated that Tony's demeanor immediately changed upon second interview. Even before they started laying out all the evidence that was before Tony and kind of unveiling what they had found, right? He got defensive, he got nervous, and even though his whole demeanor changed, his story stayed pretty much the same as the original story. When pushed by evidence of the blood, stocking cap, the impressions, etc., he added that Glenn had fallen at some point and hurt himself. That's how he must have gotten the blood on him. After he hurt himself, he also added that he took him back to the boulder, sat him on it so that he could rest, and he told him that he was fine and that he'd be okay, and he left. Other than those additions, he also added that he was blackout drunk and he couldn't remember anything. He was more drunk than he wanted to let on before because he was afraid he would get like a driving while intoxicated charge. This was everything that he could remember from his broken, drunken La Kiva Monday night memory. Those are the only details he added.
Okay, so we're supposed to believe that Glenn fell, hurt himself, not badly enough to die from whatever this injury was, and then Tony leaves, and somebody then comes up after Tony and bludgeons Glenn to death.
That's what it seems like so far.
Okay.
And it doesn't make sense to investigators, nope. Rightfully so. So on Wednesday, February 5th, 2014, the Brewster County Sheriff's Department formally charges Tony Flint with the murder of Glenn Feltz. And I don't think anybody could argue with that, right? There's a lot of evidence against Tony Flint at this point.
Seems pretty cut and dry.
He was booked and processed. So photos of Tony during his processing showed a bruise on his face underneath his left eye, and his hands were cut up pretty badly. You know, if you've ever been in a fist fight and you've punched a lot of hard surfaces, you end up getting cut knuckles. So that's kind of what he has going on. The immediate aftermath of Tony's arrest, many Terlinguins assumed Glenn Felt's death was an accident. But as rumors circulated about the details of the crime scene, Tony lost a lot of sympathy in town. He kept some kind of sympathy from his river guide friends that he had been working with, but most of the town just wanted justice for Glenn Feltz. So what about the body, Aaron? You ready to get into some physical body evidence?
Let's do it.
Dr. Rome Hughes, a forensic pathologist, performed the autopsy of Glenn Feltz. He stated, quote, "My first thoughts when I viewed the body was that he endured a lot of blunt force trauma and physical trauma. Glenn was covered in dirt from being dragged across the parking lot, of course." Dr. Hughes also said, quote, "He had several cuts and serious diffuse spans of bruises all over his body that were consistent with being stomped, and his hair was also matted with blood. That led me to believe that I was going to find some serious head injuries." On closer inspection, Glenn suffered several potential fatal injuries. He had multiple skull fractures. The majority of his ribs were broken. He suffered what is referred to as a diaphragmatic laceration and massive amounts of internal bleeding. Dr. Hughes stated that injuries like this are seen when a body undergoes an intense compressive force, like a car crash or skydiving accident, something like that. The final cause of death was determined to be blunt force craniocerebral trauma, or simply put, injuries to the skull and head. In Glenn's case, it was due to significant fractures on the side and back of his skull and the resulting bleeding to his brain. Dr. Hughes determined there were three different types of fractures on Glenn's skull. One was a large, depressed fracture near Glenn's left temple. This was about 4 inches long and an inch and a half wide. According to Dr. Hughes, this means that, quote, "portions of the skull were actually punched out and pressed inward into the brain matter." The second fracture was a chipped out fracture on the back right part of Glenn's skull, about the size of a nickel. And connected to both the main two larger fractures was a series of linear fractures that ran across Glenn's skull. Dr. Hughes explained these as secondary fractures, much like the ones that you get when a chip in your windshield happens. So there's simply just a original epicenter of the fracture and then the spiderweb breaking points that go out across. You're probably familiar with this, Aaron. So do you have any questions about the skull damage so far?
I have one question, which is, I don't really have a question about the skull damage per se, but I have a question about those boots. Were those steel-toed boots?
They were not.
They were not. Okay.
They were soft-soled and soft-toed.
Interesting.
Yeah. But he does weigh 350 plus pounds, and Glenn is a 150-pound man.
He could potentially, not that I'm saying that it's for sure Tony, but there's a lot of force that that man could create. That's an incredible amount of trauma that he underwent. I mean, that almost all of his ribs were broken, and then he had massive internal bleeding, plus all of these head injuries. It sounds like he got, like what they were saying, whoever did this to him stomped and kicked the crap out of him.
Yeah, and the coroner, the forensic pathologist, he basically said, I knew there was an altercation based on the scene, and that's part of my job is to match the evidence that I'm seeing from the body to the evidence at the scene. And since there were so many signs of a physical altercation, I'm trying to match that to the body. And the only thing I can say about that is he looks like he was stomped to death.
Yeah, and there absolutely not a situation where he fell and hurt himself.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Like, he didn't just stumble down a stair or two and then died on a boulder.
No.
Well, Glenn had 12 broken ribs on one side of his body.
Gee, that's all of the ribs.
That's all of them. Yeah.
Wow.
On the other side, he had 5 of 12 ribs broken.
Oh, my God.
And, of course, we talked about the diaphragmatic laceration. That is his diaphragm, which was severely torn and had large amounts of blood loss associated in the tearing region. So he had internal bleeding on this diaphragmatic tearing. If you don't know, the diaphragm is what contracts and expands to let you breathe with your lungs. Yeah, so the coroner said that that kind of injury is typically just in a car crash. That's the only time he's seen that. But that's a lot of force compressing the torso to tear the diaphragm. Well, Glenn had several internal injuries to organs such as the stomach, the liver, and the kidneys. On top of that, Dr. Hughes stated that at this point in his career, he had conducted 550 autopsies and that these were the most severe injuries that a victim related to a physical altercation had allegedly received and that he had ever seen.
It sounds like somebody ran him over with a car.
In late February, Lakiva's bartenders and staff, they started hearing about information coming out about the initial investigation. The prosecution and the investigators were pretty tight-lipped about it, and Tony was arrested, so they decided that they were going to go and duck under the crime scene tape, blocking off the bar's entrance, and they were going to clean the place up as much as they could, and they were going to host a big Terlingua family throwdown in Glenn Feltz's memory. Kind of like a last send-off, last party, potluck kind of thing. And they had a great time, they had their memorial barbecue, and after that, it was just the long wait for the trial. And the trial wouldn't happen for over a year. So you ready to jump to the trial, Aaron?
Sure.
The trial was actually moved from Brewster County, which we talked about. It's this huge, massive area of Texas. And it was moved out of Terlingua 140 miles to Sierra Blanco in Hudspeth County. And this pissed off a lot of people. It really rubbed them the wrong way because Sierra Blanco is a different town. It's a different group of people. They didn't know Terlingua like Terlinguans did. And they didn't know Glenn Feltz. They didn't know Tony Flint. And they just felt like they couldn't get justice with the trial being there.
I'm sure it was the defense who made the motion to move the trial.
Good job. The defense's request was due to pretrial publicity, and the judge allowed it.
Okay.
So the prosecution was headed up by Rod Ponton, the Brewster County DA. You want some fun facts about Rod, Aaron?
Absolutely.
He originally went to the University of Texas of Austin, and he got his Bachelor of Arts in Radio, Television, and Film. Not what you would get for a county DA, right?
Not typically, no.
Well, would it surprise you to know that Rod Ponton and his friends filmed a particularly noteworthy film the summer after he graduated, and would it surprise you that it was the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
What?
Yes.
He worked on Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
Rod Ponton was a grip, and he is on imdb.com, and you can find his name as a grip. He's now the DA, still to this day, of Brewster County.
Wow, that is incredible.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
I love this story.
Rod said that his film days ended pretty quickly after he realized that the only people making money in the industry were accountants and lawyers. So he went back to school and got his law degree.
He didn't get any money out of Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
Well, I think he got paid a little bit, but I think that's part of the mythos of Texas Chainsaw Massacre is that it's pretty much a cult classic and they really didn't see a big payday from it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Plus, he's just a grip, so I don't know how much money grips typically get.
Well, second interesting fact, I don't want to call it a fun fact, but he represented Henry Lee Lucas as his primary defense lawyer.
What?
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
Well, but now he's working as a prosecutor.
Yes, he did not enjoy his time as a defense lawyer, and he also...
Yeah, if you're having to defend Henry Lee Lucas.
Well, that's what he cites. He cites the defense of Henry Lee Lucas really changing him as a law practitioner and moving to the prosecution side.
Does this guy have an autobiography? Because I would love to read it. Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Henry Lee Lucas.
Yeah, it's
now
pretty amazing.
Now he's a prosecutor. That's incredible.
Well, Rod is a seasoned district attorney at this point. He started the trial out in May of the following year in 2015, and he did it in Rod Ponton fashion. He's a DA's DA. He knows when he's got the case in the bag, when he's got a defendant dead to rights. He lays out a glimpse of the copious amount of evidence that laid before the jury. And he talked about how he's going to bring specialists up and talk about each piece of evidence. He told the jury that he planned to show how Tony brutally beat the defenseless Glenn to death. He tried to say all the things that we've pointed out that detectives and sheriffs have mentioned before about there's a lot of interesting facts that only lead to Tony. Let's jump over to Justin Lowe, which is Tony's defense attorney.
Boo.
Justin Lowe is, he's a very capable defense attorney. He's definitely got that Saul Goodman vibe to him, and I'll say that as my own personal opinion. He seems like he's been in the game a while and knows how to defend someone.
Okay.
Not only is he a very capable defense attorney, it's reported that he was paid very well for his services by Tony's family. He saw all the piles of physical evidence that faced his client, Tony, and he decided he was going to go with two radical changes with his strategy. He told the jury in his opening statements that not only were they going to hear from Tony himself what exactly happened that fateful night on February 4th, 2014. Yes, Tony was going to take the frickin' stand in his own defense, which we always know that that is a wild card, right?
Oh, yeah. Which is also bizarre because up to this point, he's always claimed that he was too intoxicated to remember what happened that
night. Yeah, he said nothing.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But also, Justin Lowe stated that he was going to prove to the jury that this was a simple case of self-defense.
Oh.
I hear surprise in your voice. And this was also a huge surprise to everyone in the courtroom. And that includes law enforcement, the media, the prosecution, and of course, friends and family who are there present who know what's been going on in the investigation.
Wow.
You could hear the air leak out of the courtroom. Let's pause for a second. Let's talk about an overview of capital murder charges in Texas and what it takes to get somebody a first-degree murder charge.
Okay.
Texas does not officially use the term first-degree murder, which I don't know if we've talked about this before, but it can sometimes be a little confusing. Instead, the equivalent in Texas is known as capital murder, which is a murder for which a perpetrator can get a sentence for capital punishment. To convict a defendant of capital murder, prosecutors must be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt one of these two things that I'm about to lay out. There's other things, but these are the most important to this case. The defendant intentionally and knowingly caused the death of another person, or the defendant intended to cause serious bodily injury and committed an act that was clearly dangerous to human life, and this act caused the death of an individual. So, the burden of proof in this case is on the prosecution to put all this evidence together to convince a jury of one of these two things.
So basically the prosecution has to show intention there.
Yes.
Okay. Which is always hard to do.
Yes. And that's what Justin Lowe is counting on as the defense attorney. Mm-hmm. If he can stand on this self-defense part of the case, he can take the evidence that the prosecution is putting forward and keep using it to prove self-defense.
Yeah. Tricky, tricky.
Yeah. So over the next few days, Rod Ponton, he does the best that he can. He pulls forward. He examines all the evidence that we just went over to the jury. And he laid out how these injuries could not have been sustained from a handful of punches in self-defense. He called forward a ton of character witnesses to show that Tony was a bully, an angry drunk, a wild card, somebody who had a hair trigger. In total, Rod called forward 30 witnesses, 350 exhibits of evidence. He pulled out the mesquite tree from the parking lot and brought it to the courtroom. The sheriff, three deputies, two Texas Rangers, lab personnel, the coroner, numerous Terlingua witnesses for character on both Glenn and Tony in 6 days of trial.
Wow.
Yeah, like he did his due diligence. That final sixth day, he declared that the prosecution rested their case. Now, let's move over to Tony Flint's side of the case. It's Justin Lowe's turn to explain everything that happened. He addresses the evidence, and he tries to paint Glenn as a pothead, a drunk, and someone who acted with aggression when questioned about how he ran his business. He used something he referred to as the Bruce Lee theory as well. Size doesn't matter. And this is basically him saying, what if you take Glenn Phelps and you replace him with Bruce Lee? Bruce Lee, in his own words, was 180 pounds sopping wet, but he would destroy Tony Flint. The only problem with that argument is that Glenn Phelps was not a fighter. He was a lover. He had no recorded history of physical altercations or assaults of people. Yeah, I just don't buy the Bruce Lee swap him out defense.
Yeah.
Because that was one of his big problems with the evidence and the case that he faced was clearly Tony is over twice the size of Glenn. So he had to address that. And I just don't buy what he's dishing out.
Yeah, no, that's silly because Bruce Lee was a force to be reckoned with because of his super training in martial arts, which yeah. Glenn did not have, one can assume.
Tony eventually does take the stand after these opening defense remarks. And when he does, in his own defense, he miraculously is able to remember a lot more about what transpired that night, Aaron.
That's helpful.
Oh, yeah. It's convenient, right? He claimed it started when he and Phelps and two employees at the bar were drinking, and Glenn Phelps got into an argument with one of the employees who happened to be a bartender about how to run La Kiva. The employee allegedly quit on the spot, and Tony Flint said that the group continued drinking well after the cook and the bartender left. This particular employee states that this is not true, by the way, and totally has problems with Tony Flint's defense statement.
Well, also, based on his previous statements, he didn't say anything about there being additional people with him and Glenn the night of his death.
Yes, and there are witnesses who back up that there were four people at the end of the night, including the cook, the bartender, Tony Flint, and Glenn Phelps. So again, we're taking the evidence of this case and we're moving it towards Tony's narrative. Tony Flint said that they continued to drink Lone Star beer, take occasional shots of whiskey, and that Glenn Phelps would throw in a shot of tequila every now and then. But at some point after midnight, they headed out of the parking lot to have some more beers in Tony's truck. Of course, he had an extra pack of Lone Star stashed in there, chilling in the desert night air. He told the jury that he confronted Glenn about his previous treatment of this bartender and stated Glenn was in the wrong and that he needed to apologize. To this, Glenn allegedly got upset and threatened Tony. Tony said he asked Glenn to repeatedly get out of the car, to which Glenn refused, and Tony got out himself, went around the side of the truck, and attempted to force Glenn out of his truck. This allegedly is when Glenn struck Tony in the side of the face, which resulted in the matching bruise in his processing photo. He admitted to a scuffle at the truck, and he said at one point Glenn tried to grab something out of Tony's truck bed. Tony stated he responded by flinging Glenn against the mesquite tree and then punched Glenn 4 or 5 times. He can't remember, he was drunk, but stresses that he was afraid of Glenn and feared what he would do if he got a hold of one of those tools or potential weapons in the back of his truck. I will clarify and say that there were 2 spots of Glenn's DNA that were discovered on the tailgate of Tony's truck. Justin Lowe used this evidence to corroborate Tony's claims that Glenn had tried to retrieve a weapon out of the back of Tony's truck just as the scuffle began. This would include items such as a hatchet, a hammer, large wrenches, and other tools that were exposed in Tony's truck bed. After Glenn went limp, Tony claimed he drugged Tony back over to the front of La Kiva near the boulders where he originally said he left him. These boulders were placed there to keep drunks from driving into the bar itself. He said that when he left, Glenn was still alive, and allegedly, Glenn was still breathing. And that pretty much wraps up the self-defense part of the case. How are you feeling over there?
So how does that explain the first drag marks?
That is my question, because it seemed to me you're dragging a person, you change vector directions, you're dragging a person again, then a mesquite tree scuffle ensues, there's blood there, and then you're dragging an unconscious person back to the entrance of this bar.
Mm-hmm.
How does that match up with Tony's recollections of the events?
It doesn't seem to.
I agree.
Also, I mean, if this was a self-defense claim, as clearly that's what they're going with, how can you explain beating someone to death and the massive injuries? I mean, all you'd have to do is say, well, I knocked him around a couple times and, you know, I got in my trunk and I drove away. Not that I beat him so badly that I broke almost all of his ribs and I fractured his skull in multiple places. Those are 2 different ideas. My other issue is, again, if he can suddenly remember this a year later during the trial, why didn't he bring any of this up when he was first giving his statements to the police officers?
Those are both really great questions. And in closing statements, which we know happens after the defense has a chance to respond, Rod Ponton tried to address those things. And he took the chance to read transcripts of Tony talking over the phone with his parents from jail. And this was 3 weeks after his arrest, mind you. And he still reportedly did not remember anything that happened that night. And when he talked to his mother and his father, he said, I was blackout drunk. I screwed up. And I can't tell you what happened. So how did his story miraculously change? That's what Rod Ponton asserts in his final arguments, is that Tony Flint is taking all the evidence that is brought forward in this case, twisting it towards his own narrative to fit his self-defense plea.
That's what it seems like. You're taking the end result, which is the death and all of this forensic evidence, and you're trying to make a story that fits that evidence.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it sounds like.
Yeah, and in Rod Ponton's final statement to the jury, he says that his theory was that, quote, Tony's story only changed after being blackout drunk once his defense lawyer was able to analyze the case and look at all the evidence facing Tony and bring it to him. That's when his narrative changes. That's when this new self-defense claim conveniently appears, which took each part of the physical evidence and matched it to Tony's narrative. Rod also took the time to remind the jury that the physical evidence at the scene combined with the autopsy of Glenn's injuries showed that Tony acted, quote, knowingly. The fact that Glenn died of these injuries clearly shows that acts Tony committed were, quote, dangerous to human life. Remember those points that we have to hit to get capital murder charges?
Mm-hmm.
Rod also points out that the jury has the option of finding Tony guilty of manslaughter. If they find a way to figure out reasonable doubt in this case, they can still choose manslaughter. That's on the table. For reckless conduct and a lesser offense that was available at their discretion. However, he stresses that the evidence proves that Tony is a liar and that he beat the poor little man to death. Let's move to Justin Lowe's response. Again, Justin Lowe hit hard on the self-defense strategy during the closing statements, and then he threw in this final last curveball, Aaron. This is the what-if theory. Due to the severity of Glenn's injuries, Justin Lowe brought up a new theory of how Glenn could have received all of these devastating injuries. Remember that unidentified cook?
The one that actually found Glenn's body?
Yes.
Yeah.
The one that allegedly arrived at 4 a.m. Mm-hmm. in the darkness of a new moon that had driven through the parking lot in one of the darkest nights in Terlinguin winter?
Okay.
Remember how she returned back to the parking lot and later at 8 a.m. discovered Glenn's dead body and finally called the police? Justin Lowe hammers on this point. He posits to the jury that he believes the cook could have run over Glenn accidentally on her way through the parking lot with her car while he was still alive. He asked the jury, quote, "Where did those 4 hours go?" He referred back to comments of Dr. Hughes's testimony that these injuries were consistent with a car wreck or someone who had fallen out of a plane. He suggested these larger bruises on Glenn's chest were not from Tony's boots, which could not be proven, but from the cook's tires of her vehicle. How did his ribs get broken on both sides? How did almost all of his ribs get broken? The laceration of the diaphragm. There's medically no Texas case that has a lacerated diaphragm to that degree from a physical altercation, and Justin Lowe brought that up. Justin Lowe finished his final statement by simply stating, quote, "All these questions that I brought forward, that's reasonable doubt."
Okay. You'd have evidence that somebody ran him over with a fucking car.
Yeah. And, you know, at this point, the prosecution doesn't get to rebuttal.
No. That's so cheap.
Isn't it?
It's so cheap, because if that was actually something that you were going to present as a part of a defense and that the prosecution would be able to argue against, obviously you would both be then looking at the cook's car and any other evidence at the crime scene that would show evidence of a unconscious man laying in the middle of the ground being accidentally ran over.
Call the cook back to the stand. Re-question the cook.
That makes me so mad.
Recall any of the deputies or forensic technicians or the sheriff himself or the Texas Rangers and say, show me the tire prints.
Yeah.
At the scene. We have perfect Danner boot impressions of Tony Flint in every crime scene photo. You know what we don't have? Tire prints.
I was about to say. Okay, what is Tony's time frame? When does he claim he left Glenn perfectly fine at the scene at La Kiva?
Shortly after midnight, after the scuffle happened. So he said that the scuffle was only a few minutes.
Okay, so shortly after midnight. This is Tony's story. Let's just get this straight. He was drinking with Glenn. Glenn got really wasted. He got really wasted. They got in a fight over something. They went outside. They had an altercation. Glenn tried to grab some kind of equipment to beat him up with. So Tony beat him, dragged his body to the middle of the parking lot, and drove off and left. He was still alive. He was perfectly fine. Then 4 hours later, the cook drives up, drives over his body without realizing it, apparently. And then 4 hours after that, then discovers his body, and by then he's dead.
Well, Justin Lowe also, like I said, hammered hard on Glenn Felt's drug habit. He also hammered hard on some of Glenn Felt's employees had been using drugs and had been arrested.
What
does
it have to do with anything?
What if the cook was on drugs, drove over him into the parking lot? Also,
my God.
Also, let's be specific. So Justin Lowe really hammered on the fact that we don't know what caused the skull damage to Glenn Felt's. The prosecution really tried to get the forensic pathologist to say that it was the mesquite tree that caused the puncture nickel wound on the back of his head when he was thrown up against it, and they brought the mesquite tree in. And they wanted to prove that the side fracture on the near his temple on his ear was from a stomping. But the forensic pathologist would not concretely say that that's what it's from because he couldn't tell.
Yeah. Scientifically, they cannot tell you for sure.
Sometimes you can tell of a certain implement or the way that it hit the skull and the way that it break. But in this particular case, he couldn't tell.
Usually you can say this object or this thing is consistent with these injuries. You cannot absolutely say one thing did this thing.
But even beyond that, they couldn't even say that it was consistent with a stomping to the head. And Justin Lowe posited the idea to the jury's mind that what if his head was crushed and there was like a rock under his head that caused the back rear injury and the tire of the car crushed the rest of his skull.
I can't even look at you right now. I'm so angry.
If a tire runs over your head, how's a tire hit your torso?
Exactly. I mean,
it's just he's just throwing doubts out. He's just grabbing as much as he can. He's just throwing it at it. You know, to make the most sense of it.
Exactly. And your competing theory makes far less sense than what the prosecution has put out.
Yeah.
Far less sense.
How did the giant pools of blood happen at the mesquite tree?
Yeah.
With four punches. Jeez. Even though, you know, that's like the double standard of a defense versus the prosecution, is multiple times Justin Lowe says, oh, you know, Tony admitted to throwing Glenn up against the mesquite tree, and that's how the back injury was sustained to his head. But then he wants to re-argue that point of what if he was run over and there was a stone behind his head, and also his head was crushed by a tire. Like, you can't have both.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, Terlinguins who were there, friends and family who were there, they're furious. You know, they're ready for justice. They're thinking there's no way this jury could possibly find it in their hearts to see Tony Flint not guilty. A week after the trial began, after spending only just a couple of hours in deliberation, they went ahead and re-examined all the evidence. They looked at Tony's first two statements versus his deposition on the stand, and the jury prepared and delivered a verdict. The jury found Tony Flint not guilty on all counts.
Not even manslaughter.
Yes, I remind you that manslaughter was on the table.
Because even according to his story, if he beat the man to a degree that he was unconscious and then laid him out in the middle of a parking lot where he later got ran over, and that's what killed him, that's still manslaughter.
No. Under Texas law and self-defense, if he only delivered a few blows to stop Glenn and render him not a threat, and he felt threatened at the time, it is within the law that it is self-defense.
Yeah, but then he
even if you leave
him
a drunk person who had attacked you in a parking lot and later on they get run over, you are not guilty of manslaughter in the state of Texas. And that is what this trial hinged upon. That's what the jury was fighting between. They felt that there was enough reasonable doubt and there wasn't enough evidence. And to quote, you know, DA Rod Ponton, he put out a large statement to the Odessa American and delivering his full statement. And he said that the cook theory was a crock. He went on to say that, quote, the evidence from the scene proved that there was no vehicle that ran over Glenn Feltz. There were no tire marks whatsoever at the scene, especially around the drag marks, the scuffle, and the final death location of Glenn Feltz. The damage to Glenn Feltz was from blow marks that we believe were from stomping. Rod also said that the medical examiner testified that the object that caused the marks could not be identified because the stomach doesn't leave good prints as a piece of paper would. This was something that Justin Lowe used to his advantage. Quote, we believe the jury wanted to see some sort of CSI type proof linking the injuries to Tony's boots. That's just not feasible.
Mm-mm.
The lack of that was reasonable doubt for the jury. I don't blame the jury. I'm just heartbroken for the Feltz family, and I feel like Tony Flint got away with murder. The citizens of Terlingua still need justice. After this not guilty verdict was delivered, Tony Flint was dismissed from the court. The proceedings went on for another 30-45 minutes with everyone being distraught, while Tony Flint has already left a free man. Tony Flint hasn't returned to Terlingua or Brewster County since, and a lot of residents from Terlingua still believe that if he ever returns, he's going to find out what desert justice is. Lastly, La Kiva's still open. It was bought by a tourist who loved the place, loved Glenn Feltz, loved the Feltz family. He was a medical engineer who didn't want La Kiva to blow away in the desert wind. His name's John Helroyd, and he reopened a modernized, remodeled version of La Kiva a few years back. You can still go visit it, and, you know, the one good thing I'll say is the Penosaurus erectus, still intact. That's the story of the murder at La Kiva.
Wow. That is super frustrating.
Yeah, Ron Ponton and Terlinguan residents really feel like the justice system let them down. And, you know, a lot of Sierra Blanca's jury selection is in their mind to blame because they feel like they tried too hard to find reasonable doubt in this case.
I mean, it honestly, it really sounds like it. And kind of like what the prosecutor was saying with the whole idea of the CSI effect and saying, oh, well, you should be able to conclusively prove that these boots cause these injuries. That's not how it works.
No. And honestly, I've seen photos of the bruise marks on Glenn's torso, and I can post these with the episode notes when we do our social media blast. I want you, the listener, to tell me if that mark on his torso looks like a size 14 Danner boot, which matches the impressions, or if it looks like a tire mark. Because if I was on a jury and I looked at it, it looks like a boot to me. It really does. I can't conclusively say it's a boot, but it looks more like a boot than a tire. I want to say, too, that Rod points out the cook never drove up near the front of the main entrance to La Kiva. She always drove around the side, around the back entrance of the parking lot, and parked around back where she could start the barbecue fire pit. She had no reason to drive through that area where Glenn's body would have been. It was not a habit of hers, and she openly told investigators how she normally drove into the parking lot. And again, there's no tire marks. It saddens me, the decision that we end up with.
Yeah, that's really crazy. It is almost unbelievable.
And again, if you want to find out more about this, go watch the Badlands Texas season one. There's only one season, but you can find some really interesting, weird desert people reality TV. But they're lovable people. And they totally epitomize like what I think of Terlingua when I was out there. And I was fascinated by it. So,
well, that case sucked. That is upsetting stuff, but you know what, that's our justice system. So you win some, you lose some. Pulled an OJ.
What do we got next?
Well, next is a really awesome good news story that I think you guys are going to like, so that's going to be up next right after a word from our sponsor. This story has been covered by a couple different news sources. The one I'm going to be using mainly is Click2Houston. And this is a story out of Pasadena, Texas, which is part of the greater Houston Metroplex area. And this is about Steve Stockton. Steve was diagnosed in 2014 with renal failure. He had 10% kidney function, and he has been on dialysis ever since then. So he's been on dialysis for about 3 to 4 years, which is a tremendous amount of time, resources, money going into just keeping him alive, essentially.
Dialysis is rough.
Yeah. And he's even gone through additional medical procedures. He had gastric bypass surgery, which has led him to lose about 100 pounds, which is helping some of his other issues, but unfortunately, he still has had further problems with his health. Early 2017, he had to have his left leg amputated, and then shortly thereafter, he had to have his toes on his right foot amputated. that didn't end up healing properly, so half of his foot was later amputated. That didn't do what it needed to do. He later had to have his whole right leg amputated as well. So he has a double amputation.
I felt like this was supposed to be good news.
We're getting there, I promise. He really needed a kidney transplant, obviously because of all the dialysis and all of these other issues he had going on. That was the main goal, was to get him a kidney transplant. And if you know anything about getting transplants of any organs, you're going to go on the waiting list. It's going to take a long time for you to actually get the organ that you need. It's a very long waiting process. And so that's basically what they ended up doing. And his family, who were trying to support them the best they can, they ended up doing something that I think a lot of us would consider kind of silly or weird. His wife, Alicia, basically created a billboard on the back of their SUV saying, "Hey, my husband really needs a kidney transplant. If you'd like to help, here's the number to call."
Wow. And that worked?
Well, it didn't for a while. So a few months go by and they have a few phone calls, but nothing really works out. And then one day, they're at a drive-through Chinese restaurant.
Okay.
The restaurant is called Oriental Walk. It's in Pasadena. And they're ordering food. One of the workers there, Melinda Cavazos, saw this sign saying, "Hey, my husband needs a kidney transplant." And she said, "Your husband needs a kidney?" And Alicia said, "Yes." And she said, "I'll do it." And just like that, Melinda agreed to donate her kidney to this absolute perfect stranger coming through a drive-thru. She hadn't even met the husband. This was the wife she was talking to. And
what a whim.
Exactly. And a few months later, after hours and hours of surgery, and Melinda ended up donating her kidney to Steven.
Wow. That's awesome. I don't know if I was caught in the middle of my job and someone asked me to give a kidney, if I'd just give one forth. So kudos to you.
Yeah, I mean, it really seems like a situation where she was just like, "Sure, I'll do it." I mean, there wasn't any question in her mind that this was something that she was willing to do for a absolute perfect stranger. Obviously, the Stockton family is overjoyed with this. So once Melinda agreed, they went through all of the process, all of the months of the pre-procedure. They just had the transplant. Everything went perfectly well. Both Melinda and Steven have gone through with flying colors in the procedure. Steven has his new kidney. He can actually function and filter his blood properly right now. Melinda's doing great as well.
That's amazing.
And about it, Melinda says, "Do it. I mean, you're not going to take your kidney with you when you die. You can live on one kidney. I'm living on one kidney right now." Which is absolutely true. So the whole procedure went down at UTMB in Galveston. She says that she's feeling perfectly fine, and they even sort of interviewed some of the surgeons and the doctors who were involved in this procedure, and they said you can live perfectly fine with one kidney. It's not going to disrupt your life that bad, or it's not going to, you know, impact your longevity, but it's going to give somebody longevity. So he's going to be able to live much, much longer having a functioning kidney versus somebody who just has to live on having to go through repeated weekly dialysis.
Yeah.
And on top of that, because it was a living donor, apparently his kidney function is a lot greater and his life expectancy is also much greater than it would have been had it been a donor from a non-living individual. So she really gave him this gift of having such an expanded life expectancy from somebody that she hadn't even met. It's so incredible.
What an amazing attitude, an amazing amount of bravery and just gumption that someone could have that decision on such a knee-jerk reaction that I'm going to give you a kidney.
Yeah, with no questions asked. So they're both doing really well. Melinda is just talking about how she was happy to have done it. They're both talking about how their families are connected now. They both consider each other brother and sister. Family holidays are going to just be even bigger and better because they're all going to be like this blended family because of this connection that they have with each other now. So it's just this incredible story that is almost too good to believe of something like this happening. Steven does have a GoFundMe page that we will link in our social media and everything. So you can go there, you can look at the news article, and then you can also choose to donate to his cause, because obviously he has so many medical bills that are in relation to all of these medical procedures that he's gotten. And so their family is still struggling in that way. But at least in, you know, just his longevity and his chances of surviving and surviving into, you know, old age are much better now that he has this kidney from somebody who just, you know, up and gave it to him. Like it was nothing.
That's awesome.
Super crazy. There's also information in this article that you can look at about offering yourself as a kidney donor, which is, I think, something really interesting to think about. I mean, if that's up your alley and you're, you know, a fairly healthy individual, you can do that and save somebody else's life. So I think that's pretty incredible.
Yeah. What an amazing thing to do if you're capable of doing it. That was a really great good news. Thank you for bringing that to us. Ready for our next segment?
Yes. Podcast recommendation of the week.
Shoot. What do we need to hear about?
Well, this week, our recommendation is for Murderous Minors. This is a podcast that's hosted by War Baby, and it's a really interesting podcast. It's all about children who kill. So creepy. Obviously, it's a heavy subject matter, but I think that she handles it very well. It's very respectful, but it's also very interesting. And so everything in the podcast that she covers, it's all about, I think, kindergartners through 18 years old. So you have the gamut of very young killers versus very, you know, teenage killers, and everything that goes on in the legal system about possibly trying them in as an adult versus as a juvenile. And it's very interesting stuff. The episode that I would definitely recommend you check out is episode 10, called The Center Line. It's a very interesting case. There's a lot of twists and turns. It's something that made me just want to genuinely angry when I was listening to it. So it's a very interesting case. I would definitely recommend that to you. But all of her episodes are very good. So I would definitely recommend that you check out her podcast. Go rate, subscribe, and review.
Awesome.
And here is her promo.
This is Murderous Minors, Killer Kids, bringing you the frightening and truly insane tales of children with the thirst to kill. Kindergarten through 12th grade murderers. True stories thoroughly researched. Join us weekly for new tales of parents' worst nightmares on Murderous Minors, Killer Kids.
After show.
Welcome to the after show, everybody. This is where we delve into all the 5-star ratings we've been given on Facebook or iTunes. This is only going to last for a little bit longer until we get the Patreon going. If you get your 5-star ratings or reviews in by, what, mid-September?
Something like that.
Yeah, we'll air them on the show. But after that, everything's going to change. So do it now. Do it while you can. Let's get to it.
All right, guys. Our first review comes from TJW5279, who says, "Y'all are awesome. It's been awesome listening to your podcast, the very first podcast. When y'all talked about where y'all lived right beside NRH2O, I used to live right around the corner. So that was cool to hear. I've been waiting for a podcast that does stuff just from Texas. Keep up the good work. I'm enjoying every minute. Thanks, Tony W." Well, thank you, Tony W. Neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Our next one comes from MDaily72, who says, "All cattle. I love this podcast. Here are my reasons. 1, Aaron and Shay have great voices. 2, I thought I was the only person who used the phrase, current husband for my spouse, but Aaron does too. 3, they provide a list of their sources up front. 4, the information is detailed and really well researched. And finally, 5, they end with actual good news. Please keep up the amazing work. Well, thank you, MDaily72. We will try to do that just for you.
Sounds good. We got another one?
Yes. The next one is from Rab12345679. And they said, learn something new today. 33 years on this planet and I had no idea about this entire situation. What a terrible and horrid situation. I obviously love your podcast and have always enjoyed each episode. Cowboy from Hell was by far the best. Keep doing what you're doing and you'll always have a fan with me.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, thank you, Rab. All of the numbers in sequential order.
Yeah, 2 things. I hope that's not your password because, man, how simple would that be? 2, I poured my heart and soul out into that episode, and I'm glad you appreciate it.
Yes, thank you. And the last one comes from Peregrine Falk, who says...
Peregrine Falcon.
Yes, very good. Who says, a million times love y'all. As a native Texan, it's always fun to hear stories from my home state, but you definitely don't need to be from Texas to consider this pod binge-worthy. Turned this on while cleaning the house and found myself trying to add more chores to the list just so I could listen to one more episode. In short, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. Dumb and Busted Podcast. Well, thank you, Dumb and Busted Podcast. And that's, you know, one of the many things that we can bring to the table is we help you get your chores done. So scrub that toilet, bleach that kitchen sink. Defurminate your dog.
Defurminate?
Mm-hmm. Or furminate?
Yeah. Well, they're furminators.
Defurminate, would that be to put more hair on your dog?
I think so.
That's not a good decision.
Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah.
But I, too, run a lot of errands with a podcast going on. Mowing the yard, doing the dishes, any kind of chores. All right. The next one comes from Meech M 2018. Proud employee of the Hershey Company, Aaron. This involves your episode. Glad to hear some history on the 622 episode.
Yes, that was all about the Milton Hershey School. From our suicide attack on the IRS episode.
Yeah.
So very cool that we have an employee who listens to the show. That's pretty neat.
Got them brown chocolate fingers. Watch out.
Yeah, send us some chocolate, please.
Next up, RJ Cod 4 Pro says, my favorite podcast. Love the show and how well thought it is. And presented. Keep up the awesome work. I am frickin' hooked.
Yeah, that's what we do. We take claws and we hook into your brains.
Man, like a big mouth bass on a popper. That's what we do. We hook in there.
Yep.
Well, January Jane 226, they say, new listener here. I love the way you talk about the crimes. A fresh take, even when you are talking about crimes that I'm familiar with. Always new details. 5 stars.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that.
I'm glad you're happy to hear that, because the next one's from True Crime Queen 101. And they say, so good. Really love this show. This show should be ranked way higher than in iTunes.
Agreed.
Like number one, even.
Agreed.
I'll take it. Thank you, True Crime Queen 101.
Well, she knows. If she is the queen of true crime, then she knows her stuff.
And she's starting it out easy, simple. She's getting the basics out there. And already she knows we're top of the pyramid.
That's right.
Thank you, True Crime Queen 101.
You're the best. You're my queen. She has knighted us. Well, guys, that is everything from us this week. I hope you enjoyed this episode. We will see you next week with some cool stuff from the meetup. We're going to be giving you some interviews, some audio from the meetup. It's going to be great. And after that, hopefully another good episode for you guys. So we'll see you then.
Always remember, crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.